Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of midday for the 27th of Tevet. Today we're going to see a couple of short shivot, short responsa. The lead-off one is by the Yavetz Rav Yaakov Emdin. It's from the 27th of Tevet of 1765, Tuf Kuf Chaf He. So that was part of the reason why I found it almost irresistible, because we don't get a chance to learn from Rav Yaakov Emdin very much. And the truth is that much of the responsum is in the question, and then his response, the question and the way the question is phrased is itself interesting, and then the answer that he gives is interesting as well. So that the two sides of it will help us learn more about how Jews viewed things in the late 1700s. So here's the story. There was a certain Jew, this is in the question, there was a certain Jew who owed money to a non-Jew. And the non-Jew was taking him to court in non-Jewish court to owe the money. And the Jew claims that he doesn't owe him any money, but there was a deed, and the Jew had signed the deed, the promissory note, the loan, the document of loan, and he's claiming that it's forged. So he called for three other Jews to swear that the signature there isn't his signature. And the way the court procedure would work is that you'd need first to swear that you were going to swear to tell the truth, like we do today, right? Swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And they know that, in fact, this Jew does owe the money. And they also know that the signature is his. So in other words, he's asking them to lie for him in non-Jewish court. And the non-Jew isn't asking for anything that isn't owed to him. So you have in this case, the way the case is being presented to Rav Yaakov Emdin, you have an innocent non-Jew who is asking for money back that he actually lent to this Jew. The Jew has signed a promissory note or a loan document of some sort, and he's claiming the loan document is forged, and he's trying to get Jews to testify for him to his claims, to his false claims, to his claims. So the rabbi who's writing Rav Yaakov Emdin says, and I admonish them, these Jews, that they may not give testimony in non-Jewish court against a Jew. So that, based on, he doesn't quote sources here for it, but that's based on, there's this long tradition of Jews, A, of the fact that Jews are supposed to go to Beit Din with other Jews, supposed to go to Jewish courts, and even if they're dealing with a non-Jew, and therefore would have to go to the non-Jewish courts, there were many times in Jewish history when non-Jewish courts weren't fair to Jews in various ways, and therefore the idea was that the assumption and the presumption would be that the non-Jewish court would extract money from Jews that wasn't deserved, that maybe their law said it was, but it wasn't an inappropriate law, it wasn't a law that we respect or think of as legitimate. That was either discriminatory or whatever, and therefore the tradition arose that Jews shouldn't be testifying against other Jews in non-Jewish court. That's where the whole idea of Mesira came about. Now, if a Jew turns over stuff to non-Jews, to other Jews' property, that's called being a Moser, and that's a deep problem in Jewish tradition of being a moser. So this rabbi seems to be assuming that that's the issue that's going on here. So I said to them, you can't give testimony against another Jew in this court. And he also said, and if they cause the Jew to lose money through their testimony, it's not only that's not money that the Jew owes, so that's part of the question here, right? He's assuming it'll be Shalokadin. I think he might mean Shalokadin in that they're not supposed to go to the non-Jewish court at all, but they'll have to pay him in Jewish court, meaning he's warning them that if they go to this non-Jewish court and testify that he owes the money that he actually owes, and he ends up having to pay it, that this guy will be able to go to a Beit Din and say, they gave the testimony and they cost me money, and therefore they have to pay it back. Whether that's accurate or not, we'll have to think about, but that's what he said. Not only that, he said they'll be liable for nidui. Nidui is where the community sort of shuns somebody. It's a system that has sort of fallen out of use because people don't shun people anymore. So if you declare a nidui on somebody, so some other community will say, we don't think that nidui is valid. We don't think that excommunication, that shunning is valid. And therefore, it's lost much of its impact because people just don't pay attention to it. In a time when you only had one community to go to, and if they shunned you, you were sort of shunned, and travel wasn't so easy, or you wouldn't want to always move your life every time you got shunned, it was a more powerful use of communal pressure on people to do the right thing. So this rabbi is threatening these Jewish witnesses that they'll be liable for doing. So they said that, first of all, any money that's coming out through their testimony is not Shalokadin. it's not money that's not owed, it's money that is owed, because he owes the man the money. So they said, we're not doing anything wrong here by giving testimony. It's not, meaning the classic example of a moser is where a Jew shows non-Jews ways to get money out of Jews that the non-Jews have no right to. But if a non-Jew lends money to a Jew, the non-Jew certainly has the right to get that money back. So they said, we're not doing anything wrong here because this non-Jew is correct. Not only that, they said, you want us to lie for this Jew, but that's going to create a chilul Hashem. A, it's a chilul Hashem to lie under oath because you invoke Hashem's name under oath. And also, if it gets found out, it's a big chilul Hashem because everybody says, oh, look at Jews. They're liars. And they said, this borrower should just pay back the loan. He owes the money. Why is it their fault that they're getting the situation? It's his fault. Not only that, they said, and this is a really interesting thing to watch, meaning these guys are coming off it really well, because they said, they even said to the borrower that let him come to some agreement with the non-Jew, right? In a lot of situations, this is not something that's right, but if the Jew says to the non-Jew, look, you're going to have to take me to court, it's going to take you a year, I'm going to drag you through, it's going to cost you lawyer's fees, it's this, it's that, I'll tell you what, I'll pay you 75% of the loan and we'll just drop it. So sometimes that works. So they said, so come to some kind of agreement with the non-Jew, and then they said, and we'll pay you, we'll help you pay it. And this Jew is completely refusing any of it. So they're offering their own money, which they completely don't know, just to get some peace around the issue, and he's refusing. So they said, so he's the one costing himself the money, so we're not doing anything wrong. So this rabbi said to them, we're not up to Rabbi Yaakov Emden's tshuva yet, this rabbi who was writing to Rabbi Yaakov Emden and is very sure of himself, as he's like, he said to them that they should therefore, then they should take an oath before they take the oath. They should not take an oath. They should be mevatel the oath before they get there. I mean, they should say before they get there, they should say, listen, and you can do this. Halachically, it works. You can say, any oath I take, let's say, in non-Jewish court tomorrow is an invalid oath. I don't mean it. That's called like putting a mudah, a declaration ahead of time that you don't mean something, and that is halachically valid. And then if they lie under oath, they're not lying under oath by halachic terms. Of course, the non-Jews won't know about that, but these witnesses now say to this rabbi, you know, this trick is unfortunately known to these non-Jews. They know about that. They know that's what Jews do. That when Jews come to non-Jewish court, they are mevatel their oath ahead of time. Then when they lie, they're not lying under oath. So the non-Jews know about this trick now, and therefore they make the Jew who's taking an oath put his hand on the Ten Commandments, on the Aseret HaDibrot. So it happens to be, I'm not sure why these Jews were so impressed by that, because halakhically, if you've been mevatel an oath ahead of time, you've given a modah, you said, I don't want the oath to count, and then you take an oath and it doesn't count, the fact that your hand is on the Ten Commandments, I'm not sure that halakhically that means anything, but to these people it meant something. And therefore they said, listen, they know about this trick, and they know what we're going to do, and they're going to make me put my hand on the Ten Commandments. I don't want to do that. And then they're also going to say, maybe this is more of a problem, they're going to say, you got to understand, you're swearing by God's name now, and whatever came beforehand, that's what you're doing now. More than that, they're also afraid that they're going to get caught. And the reason they're afraid they're going to get caught is that this man, the borrower, has signed... He signed many documents of various sorts. So his handwriting is all over the place. So they write, his handwriting is famous, and there's lots of places, and therefore if they lie, they have to worry that somebody's going to bring some other piece of handwriting because it's clearly his handwriting. And then not only won't they achieve what you wanted to achieve, they themselves will be now considered invalid witnesses. They're going to be considered liars in public, and they don't want to risk that. And then they'll get all sorts of fines, and then there'll be a huge chil Hashem because everyone will know that Jews lie in non-Jewish court, and that creates a danger for the entire Jewish community, really. Right? So that's what they say. That's what these witnesses say to this rabbi who's talking to them. So now he starts thinking about it a little bit, and he says there's the Shulchan Aruch paskins that if an Akum is Toveil Yisrael, and if a non-Jew subpoenas a Jew, and the Jew knows testimony, and he's the only witness, he's not allowed to give the testimony. And if he gives a testimony, we should be mishamtin him. We should put him into nidu. We should shun him or ban him, punish this Jew for doing this. But the Sma writes there that's only if the Jew is causing loss to another Jew that is more than the loss that Jew would bear in a Jewish court. But if he's not doing anything more than would have happened in Jewish court, meaning if this non-Jew came to a Jewish court with the signed loan, the Jewish court would say, yeah, you owe him the money because you borrowed money. So if the Jews aren't doing anything more, if the Jewish witnesses are doing no more than would have happened in a Jewish court, so the Sma, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, held that was okay then. And it's worth mentioning that there's a danger to the witnesses, right? if they lie, because they'll get in trouble with the authorities, and that might be serious trouble, especially since there's halacha in Yoredei and Shulchan Aruch, it says, the Ramah says, if you have a Jew who stole something, and they couldn't prove it, the non-Jews couldn't prove it, so they made him swear in front of a bunch of other Jews, and they know that he didn't steal it, and they know he's going to swear falsely, the Ramah says, yichfuhu shiyishtafeh, they're allowed to, and they should force him to find a way to compromise about it, because it's a chilul Hashem. So the rabbi writing Yaakov Emden is not sure what to do. He thinks that basically they're not allowed to give the testimony, but he realizes some elements to their claims, and so he's writing Yaakov Emden. So Yaakov Emden writes back to Tshuva. Now the Tshuva is from the 8th of Shvat, but we're doing it on the 27th of Tevi, because that's when the question was, and because you don't always get opportunities to have Yaakov Emden be a Tshuva in our series. So he says, first of all, there's no issue here. Rav Yaakov Emden says it's clear. I don't know if it's going on for a while, because if you look anywhere, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, look at the Achronim, there's no reason to go on here about the fact that they're allowed to give testimony because they're not costing the Jew anything other than what he actually owes, and especially since the non-Jewish courts are going to make them take an oath, and we certainly don't say, especially when the sin. I mean, we don't tell one Jew to sin in order to save another Jew, especially, he says, when it's a sin, she'olam nizdazeh aleha. Because if you look in, the Gemara talks about Shavua being a sin. Before you administer an oath in Beit Din, they warn the guy taking the oath to be very careful what he's saying, because the Gemara is very, and the Mishnah are very leery of oaths. You take a false oath very seriously. So before somebody gives an oath in Beit Din, they want that person to think very careful what they're doing, because there's a strong preference to avoid taking the oath to begin with and try to find a way, even if you have to give up a few dollars, it should be worth a little bit of money to not have to take an oath, because even if you're telling the truth, there's an issue, right? So not that's in the Tshuva here, but it's one of the earliest Gemara's Mishnahs that many of us learn. If you start, as I think I did many years ago, with Hamafkid, so we talk about the fact that if somebody is watching an item for somebody else and it gets stolen or lost, and the person watching it bears no responsibility for that, and therefore is not, in fact, financially liable for it, but would have taken the oath that he didn't do anything wrong, that there were many people in the time of the Mishnah who would prefer to pay for the item, the full cost of the item, rather than take it off. So that's an early, early example that most of us know about this idea. So the Rav Yaakov Emden is referring to another idea that the world shook over, the idea of false oaths. That's Gemara, about the fact that when the question of oaths came up, the world was shook to show how serious it is. So for them to do something so serious, to take a false oath, so that this guy, who's a sinner because he's trying not to pay off a loan that he owes, Rav Yaakov Emden says, especially since who gave this guy the right? He says exactly that. Mi hitir lo lichpor bebaal chov. Who gave him the right to deny a loan that he owes, even if the guy's not Jewish? Where did he get that idea? So all of these prohibitions affect this issue. It's gazelle, it's brazen theft, it's oshek, it's taking money by force, it's all these things, and so it's very significant sins. So how would you think that we would obligate these witnesses in any way to help this Russia? So then he throws in a parenthesis, even if you could say he's poor, but Jews don't lie, right? There's a pasuk that says, Shari Yisrael lo yasu avla. People, Jews are not supposed to be people who lie. We're supposed to recognize the truth. Especially it happens to me that this man has money, he just doesn't want to pay back this loan. So the truth is, Rav Yaakov Emden says, I don't even think to help him out and to give him leverage to force the non-Jew to make some kind of a compromise on the loan isn't right, and you're helping Hov de Avera. We've spoken about before, so I think we've spoken about other times that there's a rabbinic prohibition to help any Jew, any person sin. Right, so a lot of things we can't do, not because they're lifting the iver. Lifting the iver means we're not allowed to be the cause of them sinning. But even if we're not the cause of their sinning, we often say that you're not allowed to help them sin. And in various ways, it comes up in lots of situations. There are, you know, questions of, am I allowed to do this because it's helping a Jew do something that's wrong? So how can you tell them that they should be helping this guy get out of a loan? That's a problem of misayeah, of helping people sin. So the question of, and then he says, the question of maybe they should swear falsely that they don't recognize the handwriting, and then beforehand or at the time of the thing, they'll be mevatel belibam, they will nullify it in their heart so that it won't be an actual halachic oath. So Rav Yaakov Emden says, chalila v'chas, to say such a thing. It's terrible to say such a thing. That whole idea in the Gemara, where the Gemara says you're allowed to do that, that's only where there's onus, where there's somebody coercing, where there's usually a non-Jew in the Gemara's cases, coercing you to do something that you don't want to do and that's against the law that you're not required to do. So there, the Gemara gave you an out. If you don't have a choice, but you're going to have to do this, you're allowed to lie in those situations and be mevatel the oath and nullify the oath. But to say something, even there he says, to say something that's clearly and directly against what you actually mean, that's going to be a big problem, even in that situation. And it was only said where you can say things that aren't quite completely a lie, although they're not completely true. And he says that that would be true. He thinks you're not allowed to completely swear falsely. He thinks you can't do it. If somebody, God forbid, has committed a crime that they really deserve capital punishment for, he thinks they're not allowed to take a false oath even there to save their lives if it's a completely false oath, because you're not allowed to swear absolutely against what you're thinking and what you know to be the truth. And therefore, he thinks his witnesses are perfectly fine giving the testimony. Then he goes into a whole discussion. There's a piece of Shulchan Aruch that talks about a Jew who goes and voluntarily gives testimony for a non-Jew. And the Gemara says he's chayev, and he really owes the money back to the Jew that he volunteered the testimony for. Meaning the non-Jew didn't ask him for testimony, and he volunteered it. But Rav Yaakov Emden says he thinks that the whole situation is where it's a dispute between them, and by Jewish law, they're not owed the money, and by Torah law, by non-Jewish law, they would owe the money. So there, by giving the testimony, especially voluntarily, when the non-Jew didn't call you or subpoena you, you're the cause, you're the proximate cause of the Jew owing money he doesn't really owe. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Emden says, that's where we say he's got a problem. It's true, he's telling the truth, but who asked him to step into a debate? Who made him the judge to decide that this guy owes money in a way that the Jewish court wouldn't have said so, and he's getting involved in a dispute that's not his, and he's causing him loss when, according to our Torah law, he's not obligated in that law. So, in that money. So that's where you have this problem, because there he should be trying to help the Jew, because the Jew, by our halacha, doesn't owe the money. It's only their laws, which in this case he's assuming, Yaakov is assuming, are not legitimate laws. There are plenty of cases where they are legitimate laws, and therefore you owe the money, even though by theoretical halacha you would know the money, but fundamentally you do owe the money because of dina machlokes dina. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the non-Jews have a law that costs the Jew money in a way that Jewish law does not respect and does not admit of. So that would be where the Jew's not allowed to step in, but where it's all about the amount of money that the Jew owes anyway, and the Jewish court would do it anyway. So that, he thinks all of that is irrelevant to here. So that's our first response for today, Rav Yaakov Emden saying that where a Jew owes a non-Jew money, where a non-Jewish court is really just enforcing the same law a Jewish court would, all of the traditions we have about Jews not testifying on behalf of non-Jews against Jews fall away, and they're not relevant to here. That there are situations where halacha did in fact think we shouldn't testify for Jews against non-Jews, but that's not where the Jew clearly owes money to the non-Jew. That has nothing to do with that, and especially if it's going to cost them a false oath, that's really the kind of thing that we should not be allowing to have happen. So that's Rav Yaakov Emden, tshuva for the 27th of Tevet. Another tshuva for the 27th of Tevet, this one is from much later, because Moshe Feinstein is from Kav Zayin Tevet, Tavshin Yud Chet of 1957-1958. Moshe Feinstein in Yerodea, the first section of Yerodea that he has, response in 156, Moshe Feinstein was asked by a Moel, somebody who was qualified to perform circumcisions. He was asked about, so this is in Atlanta, the Moel is a circumciser, and sometimes it happens, so this Moel would go to places, especially if there's a circumcision on Shabbos, and the people who were going to were not religious, so they would violate Shabbos, and they would do it in front of him, and he would say, you can't do that, it's a violation of Shabbos. They would listen to him, and so he wants to know, could he possibly refuse? Can he say, I'm not going to go? So this is an interesting tshuva. It's a very brief tshuva, a very brief response, but it's an interesting one because it raises the question of, if people are being insensitive to other people, how do I react, right? So if I'm a person who cares about observance, and I'm around people who are stomping on my observance in front of me, we might say, you know, well, it's none of my business. But he's saying, but I don't want to be there. They're asking me to come perform a service for them, but they're not willing to even notice my sensibilities around the issue of Shmira Shabbos. So maybe can I just say, I can't make it. Now, it doesn't come up in the tshuva, but theoretically you could have said, well, one of the worries is if he refuses to come, they won't have him the next time. They'll have a non-observant, non-Orthodox person do the mila, and then maybe it won't be valid and all things, but that doesn't come up here. So he just wants to know, is he allowed to refuse and not go because I don't want to see them violating Shabbos in front of me? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, it's certainly true, I agree, that you shouldn't be in places where people are violating the Torah and just watch it, because, and he proves it in his mind from the principle that we know from other places, that we generally say that you're supposed to appear in places where people are keeping mitzvos. Because of the principle of Rov Am Hadras Melech, which we usually apply in davening, we say the more people are around, the more of an honor and a glory to Hashem that it is. So if you say, Rov Am Hadras Melech, about appearing in certain places, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that must mean, notice what he says, it must mean that to appear in a place where there's sin going on, that would be a problem, because now you're providing more of a population to the actions of violating the Torah, and that just in parallel, or in contrast, is, God forbid, a bizoyon lamelech. It is a denigration of Hashem, right? If a thousand people get together to daven together to Hashem and to praise Hashem instead of 10 people, that's more of an honor to God. Great. But if the reverse happens and those 1,000 people get together to do something that is offensive to Hashem in some way, so that's a problem the other way. So that's what Moshe Feinstein says. He says it's clearly true. He clearly agrees that you're not supposed to do that, but to therefore not allow a milah to happen at its time. So maybe he was the only moel. He was the one who knew how to do circumcision. So if he didn't do it on Shabbos because they were going to violate Shabbos, they could do it on Sunday. But we have a strong preference to do a circumcision at the right time. We have such a strong preference to have a circumcision at the right time that we say you can violate Shabbos for it, right? That's what the Torah says. So now Rav Moshe says, so you're supposed to do a milah on time. And he said, really, to make sure that circumcisions get done on time is an obligation of all of the Jewish people, especially the person who knows how to do it, the moel, when there's no other moel, when there's no other circumciser out there, the court forces people to have a milah, right? And we know that if the father doesn't do it, it's the obligation on the child who grows up to get a milah. It's an obligation on the local court to make sure it gets done. It's an obligation on the community to make sure it gets done. So therefore, it seems that even if you have to bear watching them be Michal Shabbos, watching them violate Shabbat in the course of doing this favor for them, even though it's a little unfair, Rav Moshe Feinstein says he thinks you have to do that because of the value of a circumcision at its time. But then he says, and here's the other half of it, as soon as it's done, as soon as the meal is over, then he should leave. So he doesn't have to be polite to them about it. In other words, he doesn't have to stay for the meal, he doesn't have to stay for the festivities. If they're going to be insensitive to him, he can be a little insensitive to them, but he has to do the milah because that's something that matters to all of us. Okay, and then the last tshuva that we're going to do very briefly, 7 minutes and 40 seconds, is for the Tzitzit Eliezer, the fourth volume, response number 25. This is from the 27th of Tevet of Tafresh Tzadi Vav of 1936. Okay, so he's a very young man when he's writing this tshuva. And the question is, when we have a rotzeach b'mezid, one person kills another person deliberately and premeditatedly and all the bad parts of it. So the question that was asked was, the Torah has a system of a goel adam, that if a court doesn't get to the... Well, I don't want to prejudice the question. Goel Adam is allowed to kill the murderer. So whether that's before court case or after court case, a little bit it comes up in this response. But the question is, when the Goel Adam kills him, does he have to kill him, or is he supposed to kill him with a sword, which is how the court would do it if they caught him and convicted him? Or can he do it in any way that he wants to? I am very sorry. I don't know how far back. I hit pause. I was already recording, and I thought I unpaused it, and I don't know how far back to go. So let me just briefly recap that the Tzitzit Eliezer has been talking about the Goel Adam. The Tzitzit Eliezer pointed out that the Goel Adam, the relative of the victim, there are two cases. There are a case where the murderer would have been convicted by a court, and likely is convicted by a court. And in that case, the Goel Adam, the relative, is still the first one to provide the death penalty, unless he can't or doesn't want to or isn't available. So there, the Tzitzit Eliezer assumes that the blood avenger's requirement would be to use the sword like a court, because it's sort of a court-administered death penalty. And he points out that the Rambam says that the death penalty for this kind of murder is death by the sword. So those are things that's exactly right. The death penalty for this kind of murder is by the sword. So if the murderer does it in front of witnesses with warning and all those things, so it fits the model of a murder punished by a court, then the death penalty is by the sword. But in other cases, this is what it said, and again, I apologize. I don't remember how far back this goes, but so if I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But the decision said that the requirement to do it by the sword extend, or the ability to do it not by the sword, extends from the fact that the pasuk referred to the court killing the murderer, and it said mot yumat, which means yes by the sword ideally, but if not, then anyway you can. And the stillers have said, so as soon as we think that it's an obligation of the murderer, of the relative, to punish the murderer, and we do, because the Rabban paskins that way, so then he also has to follow the model of the court. But, and that leads into this, but in cases where the court wouldn't be able to convict this murderer, so for example, there are no witnesses, or there's only one witness, or there was no warning, right? So in those situations, the court's never going to kill the be able to punish this murderer because they don't have the evidence to do so, but the Gohel Adam would be allowed to. Now, he doesn't get into it fully, gets into it a little bit, but that's the question to think to yourself. How well do I have to know that somebody committed murder in order for me to be allowed, on a relative of mine, for me to be able to think of myself as a Gohel Adam? So one witness is apparently good enough. If it's a believable witness, one witness is good enough, right? Or if there's no warning. There are two witnesses, but there's no warning. So there, the Goel Adam has the right to kill them. So in those situations, since it's not an extension in any way of the court-administered death penalty, and why is it not? It's not because the court wouldn't be able to administer death penalty. There he thinks that the Goel Adam can kill him in any way that he finds his ability to kill him. And he thinks that even a woman's testimony would work in this case. So the point is establishing for the Goel Adam, we don't need a court proceeding. For the Goel Adam, we just need that the relative have reasonable knowledge that this is the murderer. So a woman giving testimony, if it's a valid testimony, we really believe and we know that she's telling the truth and we can test her on it. You have to be careful about this, right? You don't want to be too excessive and too quick to kill anybody. But that's going to be sufficient. The same way we trust women for lots and lots of things in halacha. So this would be another example, right? We trust women to establish various facts. Women aren't able to give testimony in court for various reasons, but it's not because they can't establish facts. So for a relative of a murder victim, since the other's there, all he needs to know is the fact that this person killed them. And there's a Rambam to that effect as well, that in those situations, the murderer has to know that the Goel Adam will be out to get him. It's the murderer's job and necessity to protect himself from it, to find a way to avoid getting killed. But the court will neither protect him, nor will the court punish him, because they don't have court-based evidence enough to end up punishing the guy. That's a Rambam, and the Mor Nevuchim also says that. That as soon as you know about it, that if somebody is to know that somebody killed, the Goel Adam is allowed to kill that person. Then since the Ezra points out that there are some Rambams that sound like that the murderer always is taken to court before the Goel Adam, before the relative of the victim is allowed to do anything, but there are other Rambams that sound like the Goel Adam can do whatever he finds a way to do. So the answer is that we try to get the murderer to a court before the relative has a chance to do anything, but the relative has the right to do whatever he finds able to do, as long as the relative has good quality knowledge. Now, that's sort of a little bit paradoxical, a little bit oxymoronic, because how can you know that you have good valid knowledge, good valid information, unless you take it to a court? So there seems to be the idea that if the relative has the right to believe somebody, right? A woman comes and gives what seems like very valid information that can establish the relative as a Goel Adam, even if it was done outside of a court. We'll try to get to the murder of the court, especially because these kinds of situations can get very, very blurry. But that's fundamentally the way the Ezra sees it, that there's two kinds of a Goel Adam. There's a Goel Adam was an extension of a court. Those would be in cases where the court would convict this person if they went through a whole thing, or even maybe did convict the person. And then the Goel Adam is supposed to use the same form of punishment as the court itself would have, which is death by the sword. If it's impossible, just like if it was impossible for the court, it would be impossible, and they're allowed to do whatever they need to do. So the court is not allowed to or not able to kill them by the sword. They can kill them whatever way they have to once a person is convicted. So too, says there's no true for a Goel Adam. But in cases where the court would never convict this person because they don't have enough evidence, not because we don't know the person did it, but because of the particularities of court procedure in halakha, there he thinks the Goel Adam has no responsibility to use the sword at all. He can kill him in whatever way he is able to kill the murderer. And in that also, once we know that means the standard of evidence, the burden of proof on a Goel Adam, on a relative, to be able to kill a murderer legitimately is a lower burden of proof, a lower standard of proof than it is for a court. And that means that when we talk about getting a murderer to court, we only get them to court because we like that higher level of proof before we will let somebody get killed. But fundamentally, halakhically, as soon as the relative of the murderer, the Goel Adam, has knowledge that qualifies as meaningful factual knowledge of the crime, he has the right to already, or she has the right, a woman can be a Goel Adam too, has the right already to execute punishment on this murderer. So fundamentally, the murderer should go to court to get the court to judge it. If the court judges it and says you're innocent, he'll go free. If they say you have to live in a city of refuge, you live in a city of refuge. And they say you're going to be put to death, he'll get put to death. And if they say, well, we know you did it, but we don't have to prove it, then he'll be stuck. But all of that is better than, even though it's true that if it doesn't happen, the murderer doesn't go to the court, then if the Goel Adam, the relative, has enough information, he can do it himself, and then he wouldn't need to do it by the sword, he could do it in any way they can get it done. And those are three tshuvot for the 27th of Tevet, Rav Yaakov Emden, on when we do and don't testify against Jews, even in non-Jewish courts. Rav Moshe Feinstein on the fact that Mila is a communal obligation, and therefore, even if it's annoying to us, there are people violating Torah around us, and it seems like we're sort of supporting them by being there, nonetheless, we'd have to go to provide the Mila Bismana, the circumcision at its right time, and the fact that Ezra on the Goel Adam, the types of Goel Adam, the types of relatives there are who avenge the killings of victims of murder. Have a great day.